How's my sound? I can hear myself. We have made it into the heart of the retreat. I suspect you all are really cooking by now. Yeah. It only gets better from here. Oh. I tell you, preparing for these talks are really nerve-wracking. And then when I get up here and I settle myself and I get out of the way, I get myself out of the way, I get such a rush of joy sitting here with all of you, being with you, really sharing my experience of the Dhamma. It's such a privilege and an honor. Yeah. So, this may be a little circuitous. Let's see how it goes. We open the retreat with the first foundation, and I'm sure we're all still practicing. A lot of us are still practicing with the body and the breath. And so appropriate, because this body is the place where all experience takes place. So I'm going to return again to the middle length discourse of the Buddha's teaching, the Satipatthana Sutta. You know, it just really lays out a formula known as the direct path to liberation through self-knowledge. It's a map. It's a pretty good map. And, you know, we really practice it, but maybe don't talk about it that much. Well, some people only talk about it. So, we've probably been over this, but I'm going to go over it again. In this sutta, the Buddha offered these four foundations of mindfulness. The first is the body and the breath. And then we skipped. Yesterday, Bruni offered a talk on mindfulness of mind states and thought. And this evening, I'm going to jump back and speak about the second foundation, known as Vedana. And I'm also going to touch upon some of the phenomena that's found in the five lists that are contained in the fourth foundation, the Dhammas, with a little d. The big D is the Dhamma, the teachings. You know, over and over again, the Buddha points out that the path to liberation can only happen by examining the truth of what we are, not who we are. That gets in the way, what we are. And the way to undertake this examination is to contemplate and become intimate. We've talked about intimacy a lot with the aggregate components that make up this vessel that we call the body. And those components range from a gross materiality, you know, to very subtle phenomena. Very, very subtle. Unworldly. And the investigation must be more than conceptual, more than a conceptual exercise of imagining the body. I remember when I first started meditating, I'm sure it had to be at least a year before I realized that I was just imagining myself meditating while I was on the cushion. You know, I was really just, you know, I wasn't in here. I was like seeing myself, you know, and and then finally I shared that with one of my teachers, and they were like, you know, you have to get in your body. I was out here somewhere. So, yeah. I did that for a long time. So, you know, to gain an understanding of what I mean by migrating from the conceptual to the felt sense, let me use this example of pain. So, when I say pain, you know, we feel an unpleasant sensation in the body, and we reflect upon it as a pain. And when we do that, we skip over the direct experience of what has arisen. And we really kind of remain entranced by a concept that's essentially empty. Now, when we bring our awareness to the many components of this particular sensation called pain, we move into a realm of intimacy, of direct knowing with the phenomena. So rather than tying all those components of what pain is into this nice, tidy little ball and say, this is pain, I'm having pain in my body, that gives us no access to the reality of sensation in our bodies. We bring awareness to the location and identify pain in all of its forms: tightness, heat, throbbing. Is it radiating? Is it a creeping sensation? Is it piercing or tingling? Does it increase and subside, or is it always there? You know, sometimes it's like, I'm always in pain, but really, is it like coming and going and increasing in intensity? All of these things are the aggregates that make up pain. So, moving from the conceptual pain into the actual direct experience in the body, this is what we are practicing. And this is what is known as direct, really the direct experience, the felt sense. And it is an intimacy that arises with really allowing ourselves to be fully present, kindly, with whatever is coming to us. We do this with the breath, with feeling into the foundation of our posture, with our objects of focus during practice. And so it is with the body, a complex system of many elements and phenomena that are continually, always arising and passing away in each nanosecond of our lives. The only way to really come to an understanding of what we truly are is to bring our awareness to all the aggregate parts of this thing here, this body here. We call this a body concept. You know, it's like, yeah, this is a body. No, this is a concept. Body is a concept. It's so many aggregates here. One of the ways that, you know, my own social and cultural conditioning shows up is in the way that I've learned to compartmentalize things, everything around me, you know, separating everything out into its own category. You know, I never saw the mind as a part of the body. you know, just like I would imagine myself sitting on the cushion, it always seemed to be floating out there somewhere and coming in like airwaves. I never imagined it as a part of the body, so ephemeral and untouchable, otherworldly, really. So creating lines of separation permeated my own worldview until I began to integrate experience and understand that there is truly no separation between you and me, that all of us, both of us, are a part of the space between us. The illusion of separateness continues to be reinforced and supported by the cultural milieu that we live in. You know, we've got these borders and we've got these barriers and we've got these cultural and ethnic designations. We've got these class delineations, statehoods, and a sense of separateness from the very earth itself. You know, that one may be the most baffling when I feel into it. Knowing that it is the earth that sustains life in every way imaginable. And the sense of separation that we live in. Interestingly, you know, we see ourselves as people who walk on the earth. Don't we? Yet truly, we are earth that walks. And we are an integral part of this greatly intelligent organism that we rest on. This is earth. It's borrowed for a very, very short time. We are earth. We are a miracle, really. Earth walking around. Wow. Mindfulness erases all of those lines of separation. It draws awareness to the subtle spaces in between experience. It teaches us to listen to the intervals between words, and turns our attention towards the gap that goes mostly unnoticed. In practice, the pause at the top of the breath or at the bottom. The awareness of not just the hindrance itself, but also the absence of it. Awareness of the absence of things that we don't see, the intangible. It shines light into the juncture of transition and points out that transitions really never stop. They never stop. That we are in a constant dance of movement and change and impermanence. Constant. And yet we're afraid when we move out of our this thing that we think is knowing. You know, what if we came to look at impermanence and transition as something beautiful? I talked about walking in the dark last time, about not knowing. What if we came to look at not knowing, uncertainty, transition, this characteristic of existence, as something lovely? It would change everything. Mindfulness drops our awareness down into the layers below the obvious and points to increasingly more subtle experiences. The temperature of air as it passes into the body through the nostril. and how the body changes that temperature at the exhale as it exits. How long or how short is the intake and exhale? How do the heart and lungs and rib cage respond to the movement within the chest, and so on? This is establishing intimacy, just like taking apart the aggregates of pain. So mindfulness takes us beyond concept into the subtle spaces of the sensation of air as it barely licks at moisture on the skin. I'm going to try not to go into too many personal stories, but I'm going to tell you this one because this brought this up. You know, there was a time when I was going through hot flashes, and it was hell realm. I'd be sitting on my cushion, and then I brought a fan into the hall. I just would just fan, and I just, you know, I would want to just scream out, "I'm having a hot flash!" I did, I swear I did. And then I said, okay, I need to make this my practice when it shows up. And oh my God, what a wonderful thing. I got so intimate with the hot flash that I could feel it before it came, because something would happen in my body. I was so in tune to it. Something would happen in my body, and I knew it was coming. But before I got to that point, I would get a flush over me, and then my pores, I could feel my pore opening, and I could feel the moisture like come just to the top of the pore and just kind of sit there until it spilled over. And it would trickle a little bit, and then it would join, and then it would be all down here. And then, I would be profusely sweating with this, right? And then a breeze. I don't know what it, you know, it was just the air in the room, and now I was wet. And so the breeze would just blow across all that moisture, and it would just cool me down, and it would just be such a sublime relief. So that's what, you know, how the air barely licks at moisture on the skin, and it also opens us to so many nuanced things, to the tiny shadows of darkness that give depth to perception, to everything we see, that without them, all would be flat on the eyes. And how much do we notice just that little tiny darkness edging all of these cushions or around the edges of the room? Intimacy. You know, it also brings you to an awareness of the spaces around the edges of the wandering mind. The spaces around the edges of the wandering mind. Can you get to that? That mind is wandering, and then there's some space around that. Mindfulness will bring us there. And even on a more relational level, it brings you to an awareness that there's no space between us. That what we perceive as space is merely an extension of the thing that we call edges. These are the margins and intervals of subtlety that we are training the mind to become intimate with, to become curious about, to be in inquiry with. Oh, these spaces of emptiness and seeming void, they're the places where insight lies. We're always looking at the thing and not really looking at the empty void where the insight is. So my focus tonight really like I said, in a rather circuitous way, will be the mindfulness practice of Vedana. I can remember when I found out about Vedana. Man, that was a day of illumination. So it's the second foundation of mindfulness in the sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta. And it is translated from the Pali word as feeling tone. Feeling tone. Not to be confused with feelings or emotions. Feeling tone. The tone is not... No, if we listen to the bell, okay, listen closely. Bruni showed me how to do that yesterday or this morning. I'm going to do that again, okay? So there is something that happens at that moment of contact. And then you rush in, it's like, oh, that's a bell. Oh, it's ringing. Oh, it sounds good. La, 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 la. All that gets layered on top of it. But that initial tone is the space. It's like this little space that we're talking about. Vedana. The tone is not the bell. It's not. The tone is something more ephemeral, more subtle than the coarse and tangible materiality that the bell is made of. Vedana is the subtle tone that is struck when our senses come into contact with an object. So in this case, the sense door or sense fear was the ear, and the object was sound. You know, I love the second foundation of Vedana because it is such a powerful mindfulness practice that's like really capable of cutting through dukkha. You know, the dukkha of samsara. You know, samsara, which is the infinitely repeated cycle of birth and misery and death that we experience throughout our lifetime. Not literally, necessarily. We're doing this all the time. The practice of Vedana can cut through that cycle like a swift sword when we bring our practice to it. So let me take you on a quick little tour of the types of Vedana, kind of a short expose. According to the teachings, there are five types of Vedana. Sukha Vedana. I wonder if you can imagine which one that is. Sukha. It's pleasant. It sounds like something sweet. Sukha. But then there's dukkha Vedana. We all know what that must be. Dukkha, 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 dukkha. Totally unpleasant. Totally. There's somanasa Vedana. This is pleasant mental feelings. Those were bodily feelings, pleasant mental feelings. And now we've moved from body sensation to mental. Domanasa Vedana, which is unpleasant mental feelings. And then there's adukha masukha. It's neither pleasant or unpleasant in the body or the mind. Same word for both body and mind. And so this is kind of like worldly Vedana, that's coarse and material, and unworldly Vedana, that's more, you know, in the realm of the senses and more ephemeral, more subtle. So neither pleasant or unpleasant, Vedana, resides in both the worldly and the unworldly. Sukha, pleasant. Dukkha, unpleasant. And then there's neither pleasant or unpleasant. And we're going to get into what those, how those, you know, play out in our practice. So it's an experience that happens in the body, even though many times it can seem like it's happening in the external world. But it is always happening right here, right in the body. And to that I will say that there are only six things that we ever do in our life. Just six. We see, we taste, we touch, we smell, we hear, we feel, and we think. Everything else that arises is an embellishment layered on top of the initial experiences of contact at these six sense spheres or doors. That's it. That's what we do. That's what this body does. Each door has its own specific object that makes contact with it. The object that corresponds to the eye sphere, of course, is sight, the nose, smell, mouth, taste, hearing, you know, ear, hearing, and so on, skin, touching, and the mind, thought. We can't move towards liberation unless we confine our awareness to ever more subtle layers of experience. And I'll say, liberation does not reside on the upper layer of skin. We must drop down below the surface of the obvious. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of dukkha going on this upper level. But that's not where liberation resides. But that's what we're mostly focused on. Oh, that hurt me. I stubbed my toe. All that. This is why we cultivate mindfulness, because that practice takes us deeper into the depths of subtlety, areas that really can go unnoticed for a whole lifetime. No liberation there. One of those subtle spaces is located at the juncture at which the object makes contact with its corresponding sense organ. And that's the place where Vedana is struck. Just like that. Take a moment and notice what happened when you saw this. When this object collided with your sense door of the eye, so quickly we rush in with our perception. It's like, oh, she got an apple. But, you know, yeah. I mean, somewhere else, it could have been an orange or a naranja or, you know, manzana or something else, right? So quickly, we jump right over Vedana. That is an apple connecting with the eye sphere. It is an object. And we've learned to call it an apple. You know, if you're hungry, you might even start salivating. You know, all of this starts rushing in on top of Vedana. So the tone of Vedana is struck in that split second where the object connects with the sense door and before the rise of emotion or story or reaction. That is the subtle space of Vedana. So pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. That's just for you to take in. Cuts through all that, you know, that goes on. You know, but Vedna's, Vedna is not easy, as you can probably experience from me showing you the apple and doing the tome. We really have to have an intention to cultivate awareness of Vedna. It can so easily be skipped over. It's so subtle. But Vedna is the subtle tone of feeling struck before the conditioned mind runs in with its symphonic storyline and the horns and the trap drums and the vocals to completely drown out the clear and unembellished tones of pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. That's like the least common denominator of experience. To Buddha. Yeah, the Buddha. You know, I like to sometimes characterize really as feeling stripped down to that least common denominator. You know, a lot of times we hear the Buddha referred to as a physician. But I like to see the Buddha as a mathematician and an alchemist. Because all throughout the teachings, they have distilled everything down to its most refined quality and gotten rid of all of the chaff from the grain. Its most refined quality. And I bring in mathematician because the Buddha got list, right? List upon list upon list. Right. Yeah. Vedana. I'm going to say that a lot tonight. Vedana is a very, very powerful key to liberation. And, you know, I'm going to get to that as I go along. I'm just kind of priming the pump right now. So without bringing awareness to the arising of Vedana, it quickly gets trampled by the conditioned mind. The practice of drawing our awareness to it can in itself lead to a great sense of liberation from the proliferation of stories that hold us in a state of discomfort and suffering. We got stories, and we replay those stories, and we make films out of them, and we look at them, and just replay them over and over again. So let's look at pleasant Vedna. You know, as humans, probably animals, basically. Let's just skip over humans. Let's animals. You know, our tendency is to cling to all that is pleasant, to hold on to it, to let it linger, to hang on, to not let it go, just to like string it out and try to come back again and again and again for more. Even though we know, somewhere inside we know, that we are eventually going to experience the unpleasant dissatisfaction of never being able to step in the same stream again. But we keep, you know, going back. We keep going for it. That clutching, that clinging is an addiction where we keep trying to get that same hit again. Like, I just want some more. Where we keep just eating it. You know, we're just not hungry anymore, but that's good. I'm going to eat some more. Or we just keep doing it. And that is filled with the characteristic of existence that's known as dissatisfaction, part of our existence. But when we abandon the trance of sense desire, the need to have more, and bring our awareness to the pleasant signposts of Vedana, this awareness encourages less tension in the body. Bringing our awareness to pleasant, simple, less tension in the body, more relaxation, more spaciousness. When we bring our attention to Vedana, we can transcend the story that requires those actions and reactions. Pleasant Vedana. Unpleasant Vedana. That's important too. Things that are unpleasant are what we tend to push away. When we bring our awareness to the feeling tone of unpleasant, suddenly we don't have to react with aversion. We can just rest there in the awareness that the experience is unpleasant. We don't have to bring in a story. We don't have to remember the last time it was unpleasant. It's like unpleasant, unpleasant. And neither pleasant nor unpleasant Vedana really tends to be more difficult to hang on to because it doesn't really elicit sensationalism like pleasant and then unpleasant. You know, it just is. It's actually closest to equanimity. Neither pleasant or unpleasant. It's kind of like we're holding it. But who wants that? We just go right over that. We tend to skip right over that one. You know, it often doesn't even come into our awareness. You know, I like to say neutral. You know, I'm gonna call it neutral for a little while because neither pleasant nor unpleasant is a mouthful. But that's how it's interpreted in the Pali. Neutral Vedana is like, you know, the wallflower that gets lost in the presence of the rock stars of pleasant and unpleasant. And, you know, we tend to ignore it, feel boredom, distance ourselves from it, disassociate. And sometimes we even try to turn it into something pleasant. Or we might even try to turn it into something unpleasant just to get a hit, you know? You know, boredom. I'm not trying to go there. I'm really not trying to not feel anything. You know that. You know what I'm talking about. So this reaction is not merely because the mind is trying to latch on to something, to anything that we can feel. I want a love I can feel. No, it's not really just trying to latch on. It's just that an essential function of the brain is to protect the body that houses these electrical impulses that animate our being. The pleasant is not perceived as a threat. It's not a threat. We don't perceive it as a threat to our survival. Rather, we perceive it as something that enhances or increases our well-being. Sometimes we see the pleasant that bring, you know, we see it as something that brings us joy. You know, when we're in pleasant, we feel like we're surviving in a really joyous place. Delusion. Not necessarily so. Like that quart of ice cream that we decided to eat one night. Not necessarily so. And the unpleasant in this realm can get associated with being a threat in the mind. There are certain neurological signs that happen during unpleasant experiences, such as, you know, the heart gets, you know, beats harder and the jaw gets tight and tension in the neck and shoulders, you know, these don't feel good. So, and you know, it doesn't really even have to be anything heavy duty to incite unpleasant. It could be green peas. I don't want green peas, you know. But many of these psychological signposts are associated with fight or flight responses that are closely tied to our survival. So it's no wonder that our impulse to push away the unpleasant and cling on to what is pleasant is there. But, you know, this also means that our reactions are ruled by a body without awareness, a body in a state of ignorance, of habitual reactions. The mind body. I'm not trying to put all the bad news on the body. The mind body, the heart. Sometimes it's the heart, it gets in there too. So neither pleasant nor unpleasant, on the other hand, is really an acquired taste. You know, it kind of resides in the realm of boredom. You know, I'm not trying to not feel anything. You know, it's an acquired taste, like ginkgo nuts. You know, has anybody ever smelled a ginkgo nut? Oh my God, don't do it. And so basically, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, neutral feeling is an acquired taste. But when we can allow ourselves to bring our attention to connect and stay with neutral Vedana, we begin to get a taste of what it feels like to rest the mind in a place of calm. But, you know, that's not usually what we're trying to do. I want to share this quote from Andrew Olinsky. He's a teacher and scholar at the Bari Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. Because, you know, I'm talking about Vedana, and it's about grasping and clinging and pushing away and trying to cut through that so that we aren't suffering in that. And he says, grasping is not something that is done by the self, but rather it is something done by grasping. The self is constructed each moment for the simple purpose of providing the one who likes or doesn't like, who grasps or pushes away what is unfolding in experience. The self, listen, the self is constructed each moment for the simple purpose of providing the one who likes or doesn't like, who grasps or pushes away what is unfolding in experience. That's about I-making a self. When we see something unpleasant or feel something unpleasant, we tend to turn our face away from it. But how can we come to know it? How can we become intimate with it? There's nothing more important than intimacy. Nothing. How can we find where it resides in the body if we are busy trying to get rid of it? so many things fall in the realm of unpleasant sadness and grief, which really are indications of aliveness and lots of gifts in there. So curiosity, having curiosity and investigation and inquiry are major pieces of our practice. I got so much stuff here, I'm just going to have to go through it a little bit. But I'll give you an example. You know, Vedana is very much like noting. You know, when you're in your practice and thoughts are coming in and you say planning, and then you don't go into the story, or you say future tripping, or, you know, remembering, you know, you create these labels. And Vedana is like that. But it's so powerful because it cuts right through the story. So it shows up and you say pleasant or unpleasant or neither pleasant or unpleasant if you can get to it. So this is what it looks like. I'm driving happily along and someone comes in front of me and all of a sudden cuts me off. And I want to say something really bad. I want to shout something. And instead I say, unpleasant. Over. It's over and done. It's over. It's over. There's no story. There's nothing to dread. You know, it's like, I don't have to go there. I don't have to do it. I don't have to take on that identity and go through all the suffering that follows, the birth. I don't have to birth that self. I don't have to become the person or the monster that could have emerged. That's an example of how powerful Vedana is. It just cuts right through it. And simple, it seems simple. It holds a strong position in the practice of awakening. It was so important to the Buddha that they included it in three of their great lists. And it's really nestled into this really important chain of dependent origination. And, you know, briefly, dependent origination is a teaching on the cycle of becoming through 12 dependent links. I'm not going to go into all that because it's pretty heavy-duty teaching. But each one successively gives rise to the next in a progression that starts with ignorance of the Four Noble Truths and continues through successive gateways of suffering into sickness, old age, and death. So Vedana is nestled right at the heart of that teaching, right at the heart of that chain, in the part of the chain that's called contact. Hello, six sense doors. It is so significant and powerful because it cuts the chain off. It cuts the chain of becoming off. And that becoming is where our suffering is. It cuts off the I maker within us that's creating a self, birthing a self every few seconds, every nanosecond. We're birthing a new identity. I don't like that cushion. Why are they talking so long? The self is coming up in order to be able to be the one that says, I don't like this, I like that. And Vedana breaks the link by interrupting that cycle of craving and clinging. I think it's kind of rocking, actually. So, little bit more about that cycle of becoming the dependent origination is that, you know, I know that we have some new practitioners in here. It begins with ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. I mean, that's the beginning of the path. That's the beginning of moving away from ignorance. And ignorance is really embedded in our suffering. And so the first truth is that there is suffering in this world, in our existence. There's suffering. We can't get around it. There is suffering. And the second is that there's a cause. And that cause is craving, which gives rise to clinging. And the third is hopeful. There is a way out of this mess. There is a way out. And that the way is the Eightfold Path, which is what we're practicing on so many different levels. So, you know, without the basic knowledge of that, we live a life of ignorance and act from a deep state of ignorance that it is ruled by our conditioned habits of mind and knee-jerk body reaction, because the body has its own intelligence and it'll react, you know, and we don't even know it happened, you know. So ignorance is the first link in the chain of suffering, samsara. And then once the self has taken birth, then that cycle just progresses through the remaining links that end in death. And death is the deep, deep suffering. So the I comes in and decides that it likes this or it doesn't like that. It craves this and it's pushing this away, which is really the same thing. Craving and sense desire are the same thing, really. Because craving and aversion are the same thing. Because if you are, you know, if you want something, if you have sense desire, then you're grasping for it. But if you have aversion, that means you want something else. So it's like two sides of the same coin. And when we talk about, you know, this cycle of birth and death, you might ask, how can we possibly become deathless in this life? You know, of course, we're born and we become old, we get sick and we die. This is the gross materiality that is only the surface. The Buddha distilled this teaching down to each nanosecond of our lives and has offered us a practice that drops us below the obvious, below the material plane. So the cycles of birth and death happen to us moment to moment to moment. Every day this birthing of the self happens. Every moment it happens. It happens when we go to the bathroom and we smell something in there. The self that dislikes the smell is born. And it happens when we go through the line to get food and we decide, I don't like that, and ooh, I'm going to get more of that. This self is being born all the time, all the time. And it's this birth that drives our suffering. And so in that, Vedana has the capacity to halt rebirth in its tracks. And this is why it rests at the heart of dependent origination and why it is such a swift practice to liberation. The mindful practice of Vedana has the power and potential to free us from the prison of our stories. Vedana. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant or unpleasant. Chantal, thank you for your kind attention. I want to invite you to just sit with those words and then let them go and see what remains and lean into this moment of Vedana. What is this moment of Vedana for you?